Državni izpitni center. Splošna matura 2016. Preverjanje slušnega razumevanja.
Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje maturitetne izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine.
Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak.
Rešitve, ki jih pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom, vpisujte v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami.
Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha.
Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Ruby Bridges, a Black American activist. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
It's November the 14th, 1960, and six-year-old Ruby Bridges is getting ready for her first day at a new school.
What I remember about that day is everybody seeming to be really excited. Neighbors came over to the house that morning, helped to dress me for school. There was a knock at the door, and when my parents opened the door, I remember seeing these very tall white men standing at the door in suits. And they had yellow bands on their arms. And I remember them saying, we're U.S. Marshals, and we've been sent by the President of the United States, and that they were there to escort my mother and I to school that day.
The Marshals had been sent because until then only white children had been allowed to go to William France Elementary School, but Ruby was black. Although it had been 6 years since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled segregation illegal, fierce opposition by the governments of the southern states had kept it in place.
So I remember us getting into the car with them. Two of them sat in the front seat, two in the back. It seemed like it was such an important day. I wasn't afraid. I remember driving up in front of this new school, and, you know, it was a beautiful building. There were so many people standing out in front of the school. Police officers, they were on horseback riding around, and they were on motorcycles, and I remember seeing photographers standing out in front of the school. It just seemed like it was such a big event. But in my mind, living in New Orleans and being accustomed to Mardi Gras, I thought it was Mardi Gras that day. It just looked exactly the same.
So it didn't occur to you that this was because of you?
No, not at all. I didn't have a clue that it was all because of me. I didn't know. I remember the door opening and the federal marshals grabbing me and rushing me inside of the building. And we went directly to the principal's office. As I sat there, all of those people that were standing outside, they seemed to rush into the building. And as they would rush in, they would look at me through the windows and they would scream and shout. And they went into every classroom and they pulled their kids out. So they were actually taking their kids home. and never sending them back again.
Ruby may not have understood that the fuss was about her, but her family were only too aware of the opposition to desegregation in Louisiana.
They were pressured quite a bit. My father, who was a service station attendant, he was fired from that job. His boss found out that it was his daughter that was going to be attending one of the schools, and his customers were complaining. My grandparents, who lived in Mississippi, they had been on this farm for 25 years, but they were sharecropping. So once the people that owned the land found out that it was their granddaughter, then they were asked to leave the property.
Despite everything, Ruby's mother was adamant that her children would take the opportunity to get a good education.
Well, she always said that, you know, they had to work in the fields and they would watch other kids go to school. And they felt like, well, why can't we go to school? And so when this opportunity came, we could attend some of the best schools in the city, you know, if we wanted to, and then go on to college, which was truly just a dream come true for her and my father. So she would always say that she felt like it was the best opportunity.
Now you will hear the recording again.
It's November the 14th, 1960, and 6-year-old Ruby Bridges is getting ready for her first day at a new school.
What I remember about that day is everybody seeming to be really excited. Neighbors came over to the house that morning. I helped to dress me for school. There was a knock at the door, and when my parents opened the door, I remember seeing these very tall white men standing at the door in suits, and they had yellow bands on their arms. And I remember them saying, "We're U.S. Marshals, and we've been sent by the President of the United States," and that they were there to escort my mother and I to school that day.
The marshals had been sent because until then only white children had been allowed to go to William France Elementary School, but Ruby was black. Although it had been 6 years since the US Supreme Court ruled segregation illegal, fierce opposition by the governments of the southern states had kept it in place.
So I remember us getting into the car with them. Two of them sat in the front seat, two in the back. It seemed like it was such an important day. I wasn't afraid. I remember driving up in front of this new school, and, you know, it was a beautiful building. There were so many people standing out in front of the school, police officers. They were on horseback riding around, and they were on motorcycles. And I remember seeing photographers standing out in front of the school. It just seemed like it was such a big event. But in my mind, living in New Orleans and being accustomed to Mardi Gras, I thought it was Mardi Gras that day. It just looked exactly the same.
So it didn't occur to you that this was because of you?
No, not at all. I didn't have a clue that it was all because of me. I didn't know. I remember the door opening and the federal marshals grabbing me and rushing me inside of the building. And we went directly to the principal's office. As I sat there, all of those people that were standing outside, they seemed to rush into the building. And as they would rush in, they would look at me through the windows, and they would scream and shout. And they went into every classroom, and they pulled their kids out. So they were actually taking their kids home and never sending them back again.
Ruby may not have understood that the fuss was about her, but her family were only too aware of the opposition to desegregation in Louisiana.
They were pressured quite a bit. My father, who was a service station attendant, he was fired from that job. His boss found out that it was his daughter that was going to be attending one of the schools, and his customers were complaining. My grandparents, who lived in Mississippi, they had been on this farm for 25 years, but they were sharecropping. So once the people that owned the land found out that it was their granddaughter, then they were asked to leave the property.
Despite everything, Ruby's mother was adamant that her children would take the opportunity to get a good education.
Well, she always said that, you know, they had to work in the fields and they would watch other kids go to school. And they felt like, well, why can't we go to school? And so when this opportunity came, we could attend some of the best schools in the city, you know, if we wanted to, and then go on to college, which was truly just a dream come true for her and my father. So she would always say that she felt like it was the best opportunity.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Andrew Eavis, the British cave explorer. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
But now, the British cave explorer Andrew Eavis is said to have discovered more territory on Earth than anyone else alive, all of it underground. Now in his 60s, Andrew has just spent a month in Borneo, exploring one of the world's biggest underground chambers as part of his continuing efforts to map caves around the globe. I asked Andrew what made him start exploring caves.
The only three things, in my opinion, left to explore is space, deep oceans and caves. And the first two are out of my league. And caves is where it has to be at.
Tell me then about some of the most spectacular sights that you've seen underground, about these huge chambers that you stumble across when you're inside exploring one of these caves.
Stumbling is not quite the right word. I would call it sort of more controlled luck rather than stumbling.
And that is
one of the nicest things I like in caves is simply the passage shapes. You know, you have in some caves you have beautiful, beautiful passage shapes, sort of swirls and rock pendants hanging from the roof and you know, pendants coming up from the floor. But then you add on to that the sediments, the stalactites, the stalagmites, and so on, the crystals. And it becomes often, the scenery is just stunning, very unknown and very stunning.
You spent a lot of time in China. Why are you drawn back to China time and again?
What the Himalayas are to climbers, China is to cave explorers. 50% of the caves in the world are in China. I was first there in 1982. I was one of the very, very first cave experts, if you like, who went in there. And I've been going back many, 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 many times ever since. What is really, really interesting is if you go into the back of beyond in China, and bear in mind, I've been to villages where you can only get to them by going through a cave. And if you go to these sort of villages, not only have they been relatively untouched by the modern sort of situation, but they were also untouched by Chairman Mao and so on. So they are actually very much like they were 200 or 300 years ago.
And tourism must have changed in China. Domestic tourism, with the growth of the middle class, there must be many more Chinese people who are coming to look at the caves in a way that they wouldn't have done in 1982.
I discovered a cave in about 2000, and I went back 3 years later, and it just had its millionth visitor.
So are you still working to discover huge underground chambers? I mean, for example, is there a kind of league table of the size of underground chambers that have been discovered?
So I haven't explored anything this week, but I was in Borneo last week. I've been in Borneo four times since Christmas. So, yes, I'm very much still doing it. I've been undertaking a series of laser scanning projects to scan the big passages and the big chambers, and to make solid models of these.
I'm interested in the laser scanning experience. Does that mean that you can use technology to see into the nooks and crannies of a huge chamber in a way that you couldn't with the naked eye?
Yeah, absolutely, and measure it to an extreme degree of accuracy. The machinery now is wonderful, albeit extraordinarily expensive, which is a bit of a problem. But a trip last year in China, we scanned the second biggest chamber in the world. And
now you will hear the recording again.
But now, the British cave explorer Andrew Eavis is said to have discovered more territory on Earth than anyone else alive, all of it underground. Now in his 60s, Andrew has just spent a month in Borneo, exploring one of the world's biggest underground chambers as part of his continuing efforts to map caves around the globe. I asked Andrew what made him start exploring caves.
The only three things, in my opinion, left to explore is space, deep oceans and caves. And the first two are out of my league. And caves is where it has to be at.
Tell me then about some of the most spectacular sights that you've seen underground, about these huge chambers that you stumble across when you're inside exploring one of these caves.
Stumbling is not quite the right word. It's a, I would call it sort of more controlled luck rather than stumbling.
And that is
one of the nicest things I like in caves is simply the passage shapes. You know, you have in some caves you have beautiful, beautiful passage shapes, sort of swirls and rock pendants hanging from the roof and you know, pendants coming up from the floor. But then you add on to that the sediments, the stalactites, the stalagmites, and so on, the crystals. And it becomes often, the scenery is just stunning, very unknown and very stunning.
You spent a lot of time in China. Why are you drawn back to China time and again?
What the Himalayas are to climbers, China is to cave explorers. 50% of the caves in the world are in China. I was first there in 1982. I was one of the very, very first cave experts, if you like, who went in there. And I've been going back many, 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 many times ever since. What is really, really interesting is if you go into the back of beyond in China, and bear in mind, I've been to villages where you can only get to them by going through a cave. And if you go to these sort of villages, not only have they been relatively untouched by the modern sort of situation, but they were also untouched by Chairman Mao and so on. So they are actually very much like they were 200 or 300 years ago.
And tourism must have changed in China. Domestic tourism, with the growth of the middle class, there must be many more Chinese people who are coming to look at the caves in a way that they wouldn't have done in 1982.
I discovered a cave in about 2000, and I went back 3 years later, and it had just had its millionth visitor.
So are you still working to discover huge underground chambers? I mean, for example, is there a kind of league table of the size of underground chambers that have been discovered?
So I haven't explored anything this week, but I was in Borneo last week. So, and I've been in Borneo four times since Christmas. So, yes, I'm very much still doing it. I have been undertaking a series of laser scanning projects to scan the big passages and the big chambers, and to make solid models of these.
I'm interested in the laser scanning experience. Does that mean that you can use technology to see into the nooks and crannies of a huge chamber in a way that you couldn't with the naked eye?
Yeah, absolutely, and measure it to an extreme degree of accuracy. The machinery now is wonderful, albeit extraordinarily expensive, which is a bit of a problem. But a trip last year in China, we scanned the second biggest chamber in the world. And
this is the end of section B.
Končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo skupaj z ocenjevalnim obrazcem položite na rob mize.
Nasvidenje in srečno!